Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today in the Middle East and a damning report into Israel's military assault on Gaza and also the Hamas attacks of October the 7th and the group's actions in the weeks and months after. It's been drawn up by the United Nations Human Rights Chief, Volker Türk. It covers the first 6 months of the war. And he's warning that what he calls the horrific violence in that time could amount to war crimes or even genocide. I've been speaking to Jeremy Lawrence, who's spokesman for the UN Human Rights Office.
We've been gathering the personal details of those killed by strikes and shelling and other conduct of hostilities. Of those fatalities that we've verified so far, we've found close to 70% to be children and women. The 5 to 9 age group represents 7%, 10 to 14 at 6.5%, and 0 to 4 at 6.5%. So the numbers are really quite shocking and quite telling.
How did you go about verifying those personal details, given the constraints? And I just wonder, what is the total number of people whose details you did manage to verify?
This is quite a slow process. We do have limited access to Gaza through our national colleagues. We also are in contact with other UN colleagues on the ground in Gaza. And then on top of that, we use the numbers provided by the health ministry as well as civil society organisations. We have a very rigorous process we use at OHCHR. To verify a number, we need three independent verifications, and then we go into more precise detail. When I say personal details, it's the age, the sex, and the circumstances where that death occurred.
How many people's details did you manage to verify?
So where we stand at the moment, it's just over 10,500. We will endeavour to go through all of these numbers, but already what we can see, the numbers and the percentages are really quite telling.
You mentioned the circumstances of each person's death. What more can you tell us about those?
What we're finding is that close to 90% of fatalities involve the killing of five or more people. Many of these killings are taking place also in residential areas. You may recall we issued a report 6 months ago on the use of heavy weapons in densely populated areas. So there were six emblematic cases which we followed there where 2,000-pound bombs were used. Now, under international humanitarian law or the laws of war, the principles are that there must be distinction, precaution and proportionality in any act.
Did you also gather any evidence as to whether the deaths of civilians were deliberate in any way?
This is what we need to look at more, because this then takes it to a whole new level. What we do know is that the principles of distinction, precaution and proportionality in many cases do not seem to have been observed.
Have you also been looking at what Hamas did on October the 7th and indeed in the weeks and months after?
We have. From the very start, our office has spoken about what happened on October 7th, the horrific events that took place, and outlined that these are indeed breaches of IHL in themselves and human rights law. So these could constitute equally crimes against humanity and war crimes.
And indeed, the commissioner has said there needs to be justice. How will that come about?
So in the first instance, when it comes to justice, we would encourage the national courts to be taking the lead. Now, beyond the national courts, there are other means as well. So there are international mechanisms, the International Criminal Court and the ICJ, the International Court of Justice.
You mentioned the ICJ, the International Court of Justice. Given all that you've said about what has been happening in Gaza, what is it that the Office of the High Commissioner is calling on member states to do now? What are their responsibilities?
The High Commissioner is calling on the states to assess arms sales or transfers and provision of military, logistical or financial support to a party to the conflict with a view to ending such support if this risks serious violations of international law. And it's important.
Jeremy Lawrence, who's spokesman for the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva. Well, in a statement put out by its mission to the UN in Geneva, Israel said the report, quote, fails to accurately reflect the realities on the ground and disregards the extensive role of Hamas and other terrorist organizations in deliberately causing civilian harm in Gaza, adding that it further exemplifies the inherent obsession of the Office of Human Rights with the demonization of Israel. Well, we did ask the Israeli government and the Israeli military to come on to the programme to respond to the report, but were told that no one was available. Well, as well as the huge numbers of people who've been killed during Israel's offensive in Gaza, more than 24,000 people have suffered life-changing injuries. That's according to the World Health Organization. Those include severe burns, head and spine injuries, as well as amputated limbs. While few have access to rehabilitation services while the war rages on, Jordanian doctors have been able to get into Gaza to fit some people with new prosthetic limbs made using cutting-edge British technology. From Jerusalem, Yolan Nell reports.
Two sisters, so small that they fit in one wheelchair. Hanan and Misk lost their mother and their legs in an Israeli airstrike on their home in central Gaza 2 months ago. 18 months old, Misk tries standing by the bed with her one good foot. But three-year-old Hanan has much more severe injuries. And her aunt, Shifa Adoubri, worries for her.
We try to distract her, but she always returns to asking about her mother. And then she asks, "Where are my legs?" I don't know what to tell her.
With Israeli drones overhead, Dia Adini, aged 15, surveys the destruction around his home in Deir al-Balah. Around his neck, he always wears his prized possession, a camera, but he can no longer use it. He has no arms. In August, Dia was playing a computer game in a coffee shop when Israel bombed it.
When I came to, everything was white. It felt like I was watching a movie. I tried to get up, but I couldn't move at all. I didn't have any hands to help me.
Dia still dreams of being a famous photographer. For now, he relies on his sister Aya to take his photos and tries to stay positive.
I try to get close to her so she can help me with the photos. If she is not there, I sit and think about the picture I would like to take, and I just save it in my mind.
The human cost of this destructive, year-long war is measured not just in lives lost. The World Health Organization has counted more than 3,300 amputations. Its local head, Dr. Rick Pieperkorn, says one in every 100 Gazans has suffered major injuries.
It's shocking. If you look at the number of people injured, 94,000 plus. And based on this analysis, one quarter of this injured, 24,000 people, will need lifelong assistance, assistive therapies, rehabilitation.
Right now, Gaza's shattered health system can only give limited help, and very few can leave for treatment outside. But a mobile clinic sent with specialists from Jordan is helping to fit prosthetic limbs using state-of-the-art technology developed in the UK that's easy to assemble. Rizek Tafish was wounded by Israeli tanks in Rafah in June as he left Friday prayers. He lost one leg and was unable to work. He's happy to be standing on his own two feet once again.
I could go back to my job or get a different one. Now I have my new limb.
As he heads back to the displaced people's camp that he now calls home, there are tears as well as smiles from his mother and his wife. Rizek is just one among many learning to cope with a new serious disability. But he's taken a step towards getting his life back.
And that was our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell, reporting. Let's head to the Netherlands now and what looks like violent reverberations from the war in Gaza. A number of attacks on Israeli citizens following a football match in Amsterdam between Maccabi Tel Aviv and Ajax Amsterdam. Five people have been taken to hospital and the Dutch police have arrested more than 60. Here's the mayor of the city, Femke Halsema, speaking in the past couple of hours.
In Amsterdam, there are many demonstrations and protests, and we are always prepared for them. And of course, they are related to the situation in the Middle East and the ongoing war in Israel and Palestine. But what happened last night is not a protest. It has nothing to do with protest or demonstration. It was crime.
Live to Amsterdam and to talk to the BBC's Anna Holligan, who's in the city. Anna, how did it unfold then last night?
You can hear there in Mayor Femke Halsema's tone just how horrified she is by this level of violence. She went on to describe these as being targeted attacks carried out by men on scooters who were hunting down Maccabi's supporters. So it was shortly after the game, and in the hours before, police already had an increased presence on the streets. The day before, a Palestinian flag had been torn down, a taxi had been attacked. So they were primed for this. A Palestinian march, pro-Palestinian march outside the Johan Cruyff Arena, where I am now, had been moved to try to minimise the tensions. But as you heard there, they clearly ignited. So as people left the stadium, the attacks began. And it was mainly around Dam Square in the centre of Amsterdam. You may have seen some of the videos. One shows a man cowering as he's beaten. Another one appears to show someone being run over. So as the mayor there alluded to, the international tensions igniting in Amsterdam, but they want to distance themselves from the idea that this is any kind of protest. She has focused on the fact that these are criminal attacks. You mentioned there are 60, more than 60 people arrested overnight, 10 remain in custody. A number of people were taken to hospital. They've all now been discharged. And just to mention as well, people may have seen reports that there were unverified claims about people being held hostage. Dutch police say they have no evidence of that, but they will respond to reports as they get them. A major investigation is now underway to try to find the perpetrators.
And Anna, in the 30 seconds we have left, what's happened to the Maccabi fans still in the city, those Israeli citizens?
Initially, they were advised to stay in their hotels. The national airline Al has arranged two special rescue flights to transport them back to Israel. There is extra security at Schiphol Airport and extra police presence all around the streets of Amsterdam. In fact, passengers, supporters have been advised that they may be subject to extra security checks, extra searches.
Anna, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Anna Holligan joining us live there from Amsterdam. More on this story coming up in a couple of minutes' time. You're listening to NewsHour. Also coming up later on the programme, we'll hear what it's like living in the Pakistani city of Lahore, where schools have been closed because of record levels of pollution.
The instant you step out, you can taste like a very bad suit, and then like your throat and the back of your mouth really starts hurting. So like if I have to go out, I wear a mask, but the air is so bad that it kind of hurts your throat.
That's coming up in half an hour. Let's just recap our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. The mayor of Amsterdam's condemned what she called an explosion of anti-Semitism involving violent attacks on Israeli citizens after a football match in the city. China's central government says it'll provide local authorities with more than $800 billion to clear some of their debts. And a new law's been passed in Sweden allowing the police to confiscate luxury goods from people who can't explain how they could afford them. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return now to the violence in Amsterdam overnight. Let's talk to Achira Beck, president of the Dutch Union of Jewish Students, who joins us live from Brussels in Belgium. And Achira, well, you weren't in Amsterdam for what happened overnight, but what have your members been telling you today?
What I can tell you is this. A year ago, a little more than a year ago, on the 7th of October, I woke up, I saw the news, and I messaged all my friends my family in Israel, if they were okay, if they're doing all right. And this morning I woke up and they all messaged me from all over the world. Jewish people messaged me, my friends messaged me if I'm doing all right. Last night, it was a horrific event, and we are still, as a community, are still trying to process what's happening.
The authorities talked about it playing into previous tensions that were there between groups in Amsterdam, different groups in Amsterdam. Can you just elaborate on what they meant by that?
I can give you my own perspective. Ever since a year ago, ever since 7th of October, there have been multiple pro-Palestinian demonstrations. And also on campus, as a student leader, also on campus, they have multiple demonstrations with encampments and damages leading up to more than 4.5 million euros. The last few weeks, these demonstrations didn't end. They kept going, and friends of mine have been arrested, have been assaulted. These tensions are one of the things that the mayor is talking about. In this year, we had more than 3,000 demonstrations in Amsterdam, more than the police can handle, I would say.
And do you think some of the violence last night was premeditated?
We've been looking on Instagram accounts from people who we know who are involved in these kinds of groups. And what we can see is that some of these events was planned. It was definitely planned.
And what about the Maccabi fans? I mean, there is a segment of those supporters known for their hardcore, even racist views. Might they have exacerbated some of those tensions, do you think?
What these Maccabi fans have done is well known as football hooligans. But this doesn't justify Jews and Israelis being hunted down the street, being chased down, being thrown into canals, being run over by cars.
And so what needs to happen now to make the community feel safe?
First of all, we need the support of our mayor, of our municipality, of our government. We, as a Jewish community, were already talking about our own security, what we can do ourselves. And we are working together with the police to make sure these things don't happen again.
But you want them to step up security in the days and weeks ahead, I imagine.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And the most part, also important part, is communication. I'm happy to say that we have a good connection with the police, and we'll see what we can do.
Ahira, thank you very much indeed. That was Ahira Beck, who's president of the Dutch Union of Jewish Students. Now, the BBC has seen evidence that the Azerbaijani team running the latest United Nations Global Climate Conference has used its role to facilitate potential fossil fuel deals. COP29, as the summit's known, will open in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, on Monday. The hosts haven't responded to the BBC's claims. These big climate meetings are meant to encourage countries to be more ambitious when it comes to tackling climate change. And yet, it's the second year in a row that the BBC has revealed alleged wrongdoing by the host government. Here's the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowland.
COP29 is definitely the most important event of this year.
It is the world's biggest climate conference.
This is the time when everyone needs to come together.
But it seems the chief executive of the COP29 team has other things on his mind.
We have a lot of pipeline infrastructure. We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed.
Mr. Soltanov thinks he's talking to a potential sponsor. In fact, the man is from the human rights organisation Global Witness and is posing as the head of a Hong Kong company which wants to make fossil fuel investments. Mr. Soltanov, who is also the Deputy Energy Minister of Azerbaijan, does talk about tackling climate change.
So the purpose is solving climate crisis. So as long as anybody, including oil and gas companies, could come with solutions, our doors are open.
But he wasn't just open to climate solutions, he was open to discussions about oil and gas deals too. Mr. Soltanov is also on the board of SOCAR, the Azeri State Oil and Gas Company.
There are a lot of joint ventures that could be established, potential joint ventures. Our SOCAR trading is trading oil and gas all over the world, including in Asia.
He is eager to get discussions going.
This is something that you need to be talking to SOCAR, and I would be happy to create a contact between yourself and them, your team and their team, so that they can start discussions.
A couple of weeks later, the Hong Kong investment company received an email. One of SOCAR's most senior executives wants to meet in Baku and says Mr. Soltanov said to get in touch. Now, attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official.
C'est un petit marteau, mais je pense qu'il peut faire de grandes choses.
The Costa Rican diplomat Cristiana Figueres was in charge of the UN climate process during the landmark COP conference in Paris in 2015.
It's completely unacceptable. The expectation that anyone would go to the COP to cut new deals on fossil fuels is not only contrary and egregious to what a conference of the parties on climate change is, it is frankly a betrayal of that very process.
These UN climate conferences are supposed to be about reducing the world's use of oil and gas, not selling more of the stuff. The UN's code of conduct says officials should remain impartial and avoid any conflicts of interest. Neither the Azeri COP29 team or SOCAR offered any response to our request for comment. The UN did not comment directly, but stressed its requirement for impartiality from all officials.
Hearing no objection, it is so decided.
Last year, the BBC obtained leaked documents which revealed plans by the UAE to use its role as host of COP28 to strike oil and gas deals. Yet, for the first time, the world agreed at that conference the need to transition away from fossil fuels. It shows progress could still be made at COP29.
And that was the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, reporting there. You're listening to NewsHour for the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. Let's talk about arm wrestling now. Long seen as a friendly duel between, friends, often in pubs and bars, arm wrestling is now gaining more credibility in the world of competitive sport, especially in Africa. Ghana said it plans to build a state-of-the-art training centre for the sport. And this year, arm wrestling made its debut at the African Games in Accra, where a 14-year-old schoolgirl from South Africa was among the medalists. So, what does it take to make it as an arm wrestling champion? BBC Sport Africa's Eshlyn Verdun has been finding out.
Are you guys ready? Go!
Members of the Supernova Arm Wrestling Club here in Gauteng in South Africa showing off their skills in a sport which, according to the Ultimate Arm Wrestling League, has a history dating back more than 4,000 years.
Don't move. Ready, go. Winner.
Arm wrestling is one of those sports where you don't have to be the strongest to be the best. You just have to know what you're doing. You've got to understand the technique.
Rosemary Bota is a former multiple national arm wrestling champion and represented her country at the World Championships. She's now president of the South African Arm Wrestling Federation and mentors budding competitors here at the Supernova Club, which is based at her home. They include 14-year-old Mary Prinsloo, who won a bronze medal at this year's African Games in Ghana.
It was very stressful because I'm not good in front of crowds, and those women were very strong.
Bota had no hesitation in sending Prinsloo.
The first time I pulled against her, she kicked me. I was down so fast, it was just not funny. I then realized that I'd have to use all the technique I have in the book to beat her.
Arm wrestling is a sport with low cost and can be promoted among people with disabilities. Bota also wants to encourage more women to take up the sport.
I promote it as a feminine sport, not just as a sport to show off your testosterone and ego.
Are you ready? Go!
I was terrible when I started arm wrestling. I wasn't able to win a single medal, but I still loved it. I just loved that camaraderie, that opportunity to try and be better than the next person.
As part of the new generation, 14-year-old Mary Prinsloo is keen to break the stereotypes which depict arm wrestling as a pub sport.
It's not really a bar sport. The bar sport is you go, you're drunk, and you arm wrestle. But arm wrestling is you go to the table and you're an athlete and you know what you're doing. It's not just you push and you go. It's technique and you have a passion for the sport.
Although still at high school, Prinsloo is hoping to build on her African Games success. And who knows, maybe she can achieve her dream of becoming a world champion one day.
Ready, go. Winner.
That report by BBC Sport Africa's Eshlyn Vedan. You're listening to NewsHour. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Donald Trump has announced that one of his campaign managers, Susie Wiles, will serve as his White House chief of staff when he returns to the White House next year. She's the first big appointment of his incoming team and the first woman to hold the post. Let's talk to the BBC's Will Grant, who joins us from West Palm Beach in Florida, home of the Trump campaign. Will, what more can you tell us about Susie Wiles?
Well, she's pretty synonymous with this state in the sense that she has really brought to the fore two of its governors in recent years. She was the chief of staff for the campaign for Rick Scott. She helped bring him to the governorship in 2010, and then she did the same more recently for Ron DeSantis. So she's a really formidable campaign manager. Indeed, Donald Trump spoke of her saying that she's tough, smart, innovative, universally admired and respected. She is considered a very, very formidable political operator, to be honest. And I think the only point that I've seen raised questioning her is whether or not she can translate, you know, that success as a campaign manager to similar success inside the White House. But I don't think anybody's casting aspersions on her experience. She certainly knows what she's doing in terms of Donald Trump's campaign.
And she's got to keep the show on the road as chief of staff, doesn't she? And he famously went through, what, four chiefs of staff in his last term?
Yeah, I mean, working for Donald Trump can be fraught. We know that. He moves through people if they fall out very, very quickly. Some people have even faced charges or gone to jail for working for Donald Trump. And he demands absolutely unwavering loyalty. I think in the case of Susie Wiles, he will obviously get that loyalty. You know, obviously there's a lot to do in that job. It's a very, very complicated role. But I think he's confident that because this campaign has perhaps been the best of his three, that's how he put it, he has real confidence that she would be able to kind of keep a lid on everything in the White House and oversee the vision, really, which is what we're talking about, that he has for the United States. The planks of the platform that he put in front of the American people, he now needs to turn into actual policy.
And Will, just briefly, if you can, I mean, the other senior appointments, when are we expecting those to be announced?
I think it still might take a few days. We get the impression here in Palm Beach that there are a lot of people sort of making their way here, maybe having meetings at Mar-a-Lago. It's not like when he was in Trump Tower 8 years ago. You could see who was coming in and coming out. Mar-a-Lago is a lot better protected, and you can't really tell who's here. What I do think is, in the running for Secretary of State, such an important appointment, there is Marco Rubio, the Florida senator, and I think he has been angling for that. But there are other people too, including possibly Mike Pompeo, formerly Defense Secretary. So, that, you know, we're going to start hearing things, I think, in due course, but I don't see that Donald Trump is in any great rush to let everybody know who's putting into those appointments just yet.
Yeah, he's certainly got quite a bit of time. Will Grant joining us live there from Florida. Well, back in 2020, Joe Biden did better with young men than Donald Trump by about 11 points. This time around, Mr. Trump scored better with young men than Kamala Harris by a couple of points, including among young black men and young Hispanic men. So why? Well, there did seem to be a concerted effort during the long months of the campaign to go after that particular demographic, with appearances by Donald Trump on podcasts popular with young men, sometimes called bro podcasts, and apparently at the urging of his teenage son, Barron. In the closing days of the campaign, he did appear on America's most popular podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience. Most of his listeners are men.
It's a whole new world out there.
It's a different world.
And but, you know, I'm on TikTok now.
Congratulations.
And I've done really well. No, but you know the crazy? Have you seen the numbers? Billions, like billions of hits. It's crazy.
I'm sure. TikTok's a wild application,
and I've gone up 30 points. A Republican is always down 30 with young people. I'm plus 30.
Let's talk to Richard Reeves, sociologist at the American Institute for Boys and Men, a U.S. research organization. Richard, good to have you with us on the program. Were you surprised that Donald Trump did so much better with young men this time around?
I wasn't surprised, James, because the polls had been predicting that in the run-up to the election. Perhaps the surprise on the men's side was that the men turned out. Typically, it's a lower turnout group. And the concern on the Republican side was actually less that they reached those men and persuaded them. It was more a question of whether they would actually get to the voting booths or not. Meanwhile, on the Democrat side, there was a lot of confidence that not only were they going to win the votes of young women, but that those young women would turn out. Actually, they both turned out, but the Democrats also did significantly worse among young women as well as among young men. So they both groups shifted right. But it had been pretty well trailed. And you've already mentioned his appearance on Joe Rogan. J.D. Vance also appeared there. These are three-hour podcasts. And last time I checked, I think that it had 45 million views, the Joe Rogan interview with Donald Trump. And Kamala Harris decided not to go on Joe Rogan. So to some extent, you know, the polls were pointing that way. And then in the closing days, as you suggest, the Trump campaign really did a good job of meeting men where they are.
So, and if they did turn out, that's just a level of motivation. I'm just wondering, I mean, what is the appeal of a 78-year-old man to an 18-year-old young man?
Well, don't forget, Joe Biden, as you pointed out at the top of this segment, did pretty well among that group as well.
So is it just that they're both men? Is that it?
We can't accuse them of ageism, that's for sure. But no, and it's interesting, if you look at focus groups where young men in particular, where it's suggested to them that perhaps sexism is motivating them, then that actually drives them into the arms of the right. And so I think there's an important lesson there that as we think about the reasons why young men voted this way, which was largely about the economy, if we're being honest, rather than about these cultural issues. And if the left and the Democrats are too quick to point to sexism as the underlying cause of this, that's the recruiting sergeant for the next election for the right, because they react very badly to the idea, they're offended by the idea that the only thing that could possibly be motivating them is sexism.
Interesting, though, you say that, I mean, it's probably true of all groups, isn't it? But actually, the economy may have been the motivating factor for those young men. I mean, is it simply the idea that they believe Donald Trump is offering them a better future?
Yeah, The economy weighed very heavily for this group, for all groups, of course, but particularly for young men who are, you know, struggling, certainly by comparison to young women in education. There's huge gender gaps now on US college campuses. They're 60-40 female male. We see young men are much more likely to be still living at home with their parents. They're less likely to be buying a home than single women, for example. And so 20-something men in the US are struggling on lots of fronts, including economically. And so that kind of economic message that actually I can help you economically, it seems to have resonated quite strongly with them. And so I don't think we should overinterpret the votes of young men or indeed young women as largely driven by these questions of gender. But I do think it's worth saying that the Democrats didn't really contest for this vote. They, you know, it's not just Joe Rogan. They didn't really spend much time or money really going after the votes of young men. And the reason why is that they assumed that they were going to do so well among women, especially young women, that to some extent they didn't need to. Well, that turns out to have been a fatal political miscalculation.
Right. So they took them for granted.
A little bit. And I think, honestly, I think if you're talking to people now who are looking at the tea leaves of this election, of course, there's still exits, all the usual caveats. But perhaps the biggest surprise is just how badly the Democrats did among women, and especially among young women. Like, nobody expected such a big shift among young women, depending on which poll you look at. But it was certainly a rightward shift across the board. And so that's, to me, pretty strong evidence that this wasn't largely being driven by questions of gender or abortion, etc. Because if you lost so much ground among young women who are very, very liberal on those issues, and both young men and young women were very supportive of the Democrat position on abortion, it just turns out that this was an election that was about other things.
Yeah. Richard, interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Richard Reeves of the American Institute for Boys and Men. Well, last night, Vladimir Putin delivered his first public comments on the US election result. He congratulated Donald Trump and said he was ready for dialogue. So are these the first tentative steps towards a reset between Moscow and Washington? If so, that will worry Ukraine, which has been locked in a bloody war with Russia for nearly 3 years and relies heavily on American military aid. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg followed President Putin to southern Russia to gauge reaction to Donald Trump's victory.
You know, in Russia, not all big announcements are delivered in the Kremlin. I'm up a mountain above the Black Sea resort city of Sochi, looking out across snowy peaks and forests. It is stunningly beautiful. And it's here that Vladimir Putin has chosen to make his first public comments about Donald Trump winning back the White House.
President of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin.
Applause for the Kremlin leader as he arrives at an event on the mountain, the annual meeting of an international discussion club. First, Putin calls Trump a brave man for the way he handled himself during last July's assassination attempt. Then more praise for wanting better relations with Russia. Moscow, I think, sees plenty of pluses from a Trump presidency. The Kremlin, I think, is hoping Donald Trump will help end the war in Ukraine in a way that benefits Russia. And political scientist Sergei Karaganov can see another advantage.
Trump will spur the retreat of the United States from the position of a global superpower to a position of a global normal power.
Do you think Russia now has a friend in the White House?
We have an enemy, but a bit more responsible one. But a bit less predictable one, too.
Unpredictability? Well, there is that. One Russian newspaper this week wrote that Donald Trump was like an unguided missile. He can fly off in any direction. Plus, remember last time Trump was in the White House? Russia and America didn't exactly hit it off. Andrei Kartunov is from the Russian International Affairs Council. Here at the discussion club, he tells me what he's hoping for now the U.S. election is over.
I hope that at least some communication lines between Moscow and Washington, D.C. will be restored under Trump. It does not mean that the two sides will come to a common denominator or reach consensus on any serious issues, but to restore communication lines is still something which is very important, and we do not have it right now.
The title of this particular session of the discussion club is Together into a New World. It's almost as if they knew what was coming. If you're Ukraine, This new world is frightening. Many Ukrainians fear that a Trump administration won't stand by their country. But to Vladimir Putin, the post-US election world is a place in which he clearly feels more confident and more powerful.
That was our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, reporting there from Sochi in southern Russia. You're listening to the BBC. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. A blanket of thick smog continues to cover Pakistan's second largest city, Lahore, today. It's so bad the authorities have ordered schools to close and told people to stay indoors. The Air Quality Index, or AQI, in the city's passed the 1,000 mark several times this week. Anything above 300 is considered hazardous. Well, the cause is a toxic brew of vehicle fumes, industrial pollution, and fires lit by farmers to clear their fields. That combined with the onset of winter. Aisha Nazir is a mother of five who lives in Lahore and is the founder of an online community of mothers in Pakistan. She's been telling me what it's like living in the city.
Lahore right now is the worst kind of prison you can imagine. When we were under lockdown for COVID, children could go into the garden. They could run from room to room. They could, you know, still go into big open spaces like a park. Right now, it is impossible to maintain good air quality even inside the houses. So the end result is that I am a mom to five kids, two of whom are severely sick. Despite my best attempts, I've locked the room, sealed the windows, put two air purifiers. And even then, I'm not doing the best I can.
And when you say your children, two of your children are severely sick, what's happened to them?
So one is two and one is six. They're suffering from a really bad cough. Their eyes are swollen up. They have runny noses. So it's just the body's immune system responding to all these irritants. My children are not the only one. There are like hundreds and thousands of children right now sick in Lahore.
Can you just describe for us, I mean, what does it look like? What does it feel like? Presumably, if you do go outside, you can taste it in the air, right?
It's as if, you know, as if you're in a bad movie where the lens is just clouded out because everything's very gray and dismal. Your eyes begin watering the instant you step out. You can taste like a very bad suit. And then like your throat and the back of your mouth really starts hurting. So like if I have to go out, I wear a mask, but the air is so bad that it kind of hurts your throat. So then you constantly have to drink water, take vitamin C, wear protective glasses. Nothing helps.
And presumably there are lots and lots of people in Lahore who can't afford, for example, air purifiers, perhaps can't afford the technology to make sure their children carry on with their schoolwork while they're not allowed to go to school.
The horrible thing with smog is, even if you can, like I can afford air purifiers, even I'm unable to keep my children safe because we're talking about the very air that they're taking in is poisonous. You know, even educated mothers on WhatsApp groups are complaining about schools going online. And I'm like, do you understand? Our children are losing 10 years of their life. That's a WHO statistic. Of course, I'm against online schooling. But given the current situation where even keeping them safe in a room is impossible, there is basically no good solution till the government develops political will and understands that they need to rethink the entire calendar of the country.
You mentioned the government. I mean, is that who you blame for the situation or does responsibility
yes,
lie?
Yes, 100%, 150%. Like now, literally now, they're still not imposing an emergency. Lahore is not just the most polluted city in the world. We have levels that I think the WHO could not even imagine people would survive in. Till the awareness sinks in, only then can you expect action.
Aisha Nazir, mother of five, speaking to me from Lahore. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban says he thinks the US will quit the war in Ukraine when Donald Trump becomes president in January, and he's warned that Europe will not be able to pay for it without American funding. Mr. Orban is seen as an ally of Vladimir Putin, and he's an unabashed admirer of Mr. Trump. Well, his comments come after a major summit of European leaders in the Hungarian capital Budapest on Thursday, at which Ukraine was the big issue. Among the delegates, the Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo. Does he expect Mr. Trump to quit helping Ukraine?
I don't think that will happen. And that is because I think we clearly need to explain that the war in Ukraine today is not a war that has only an impact on Europe. Today, we see that North Korea is active there. We see that China is actually not really hiding that it plays a role in that war. So if the United States have today, for example, a clear message to be given to China, it starts with the war in Ukraine.
Are you not then one of those who would support a negotiated settlement with Russia now over Ukraine that might involve Ukraine giving up some of its territory?
Well, this war will end with a negotiation at some point. That's how wars end. But it's up to Ukraine to decide when the right moment is there. And we as Europeans are very clear, and this was a united message from the 27 after the meeting we had here yesterday, is that we are committed to continuing supporting Ukraine, and it will be sufficient, and it will be sufficient in time. And today, already more than half of the military support is actually coming from European countries.
But the support for Ukraine isn't sufficient, is it? Because Russia's still making advances, particularly in eastern Ukraine.
In a situation of war, the support never is sufficient. But I think that we have shown that we are able to keep it up in time. We are able to come up with new formulas. This $40 billion fund, which is being financed with the proceeds of the frozen assets, is something that has been put together at the G7 level. Should we do everything to do more, faster and more efficient? Yes.
Part of that standing shoulder to shoulder, if we go back to when Donald Trump was last president and he called on fellow NATO members to up their defence spending to 2% of GDP. I mean, many countries still aren't at that 2% level, including your own country, Belgium, are they?
And that is a criticism which is legitimate. But compared to 4 years ago, lots of things have changed. All European countries, also my own, have in a significant way increased their military spending. In our case, it's more than plus 30% that we have done.
How strong is Europe's political will, given some of the sort of internal political problems that countries are having? Your own, for example, the difficulties in forming a government. Also in Germany, political paralysis, and also in France. Is that stymieing Europe's will when it comes to an issue like Ukraine?
No, it's not. And the fact that when you have a club of 27 countries, that there is at some point always one of those democracies where a government is stopping, or where there is a political blockade, or where a government is being formed, that's almost statistics. Democracies have their fluctuations, and I'd rather be in a democracy where there are fluctuations than to be in a dictatorship where there are no fluctuations whatsoever, where the people are less well off.
The Belgian Prime Minister, Alexander De Croo, speaking to me from Budapest. And that brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for being with us. Until the next time, bye-bye.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.